Welcome to the Psych Podcast, the podcast where I'm joined by my friend and my colleague, Paul Bloom, to talk about all sorts of topics in intro psych. Paul, how are you doing?
I am doing great. It is wonderful to talk with you today.
As always. So what are we talking about today?
We are talking today about how people differ. And this is a departure from what we've been talking about so far. We have been talking so far pretty much about human universals. Universals of language and memory and social interaction, development, the brain, consciousness. Basically, you know, the story of the human mind as studied as you know, in as at an abstract level that applies to everybody. And I honestly think that's the stuff of great science. But we are now asking a question probably people are more interested in everyday life, which is how people differ from one another. Why do they differ? What can we do about these differences? Where do these differences come from? And so on.
You know, I think that if you just asked random people what it is that psychologists study, and you said just list a bunch of topics, I bet you that they would probably overestimate the amount of time psychologists spend thinking about differences and studying differences compared to how much time we spend thinking and talking and studying universals. Because to the extent, for instance, that you can use psychology to guide your everyday interactions with people, some of the more interesting questions are, why am I different from this person? What makes me more anxious or what makes me more empathic? So much of what everyday people might be interested in is about differences across individuals.
I think that's right. I think the first thing people say when they hear that you're a psychologist or I'm a psychologist is something like, you know, oh, my teenage son, he's having all these problems. or I have these weird dreams, or my cousin is schizophrenic or something like that. And of course, that's a very specific type of difference. That's a difference where you deviate from what people see as healthy. And then if you persuade them, no, I don't do that sort of thing, I'm not a therapist, then they'll move to other sorts of differences. Differences we're naturally interested in. Why are people smarter than each other, crueler than each other, kinder, introverted, extroverted? How do you make sense of all of these differences? Because that's how we define ourselves in the world. I mean, I don't walk around with a bunch of people and say, wow, we all get angry when provoked. We all see the world as in terms of 3D shapes.
Did you know that Joe can keep 7 ± 2 things in his short-term memory?
That's right. That's right. That's right. Yeah. Mary has after images when light hits her eyes. Do tell.
The perception example is interesting. Just look at the phenomenon that was that dress, the black and blue dress or the golden and white dress, is a perceptual illusion that got turned into an individual difference test of some sort, right? It became a meme because people saw different things.
That's right. So even when we study universals like visual perception, what grabs people is when there's differences, when people see that very same scene in a different way. A topic we're both interested in is differences in conscious experience. We're all conscious, but some people, say, have vivid mental imagery and others don't. This is an important part of psychology. People are interested in differences. We could break it up in all sorts of ways. We have ways of talking about what the differences are, like how to make sense of them. We have different theories as to why there are differences and where they come from, their implications. It's sometimes a troubling topic because sometimes you get to differences of a sort where it does seem like one way of being is better than another way. Some people are far more violent and cruel than others. Some people have difficulty doing even basic reasoning. Some people are subject to serious depression. We'll talk about the clinical stuff later on, but differences are the stuff of life.
When you're organizing your social world, so many of the questions that you might have are the what sort of person you want around you. What sort of person do you want to date? What sort of person do you want to go into business with? What kinds of personalities do you find compatible with yours? We're constantly making decisions like that, and we're constantly evaluating people on these dimensions. So it totally makes sense to me that this would be one of the deeper features of our own psychology, that is to look out for differences.
Yeah, and we're not only sensitive to differences in other people, we're sensitive to the ways in which we ourselves are special. And to be special means to be different from other people in certain ways. And sometimes we might celebrate these differences. We might be really pleased that we're good at something that most people aren't good at. We talked before, and when talking about social psychology, about a better than average effect, where many people think that in all sorts of ways, we are funnier, more supportive friends, better drivers than most everybody else. And that's a difference too, whether or not it's true. I think we're also sometimes sensitive to ways which we fall short. You could look at other people and say, I wish I was like that. I wish I had her gentleness of spirit. I wish I had his sense of humor.
Why don't we just go ahead and start with one of the biggest areas of, I guess, my field broadly. So I'm a social psychologist, but social psychology has traditionally been lumped together with personality psychology. So let's start there with personality.
And let's start by giving you a hard time, or okay, giving your field a hard time. So back when I took psychology, and I do not think this is an urgent issue anymore, but there was apparently a big debate over whether personalities existed.
Oh yeah, it's like the Great Schism.
The Great Schism. So now, this seems idiotic to me.
Like, to be fair, it's not whether or not they existed, it's whether or not they predicted behavior.
Right, okay, rather than they predicted behavior. But I know you, and I know you have a certain personality, all to the good, and I could predict that, you know, you are reasonably social, extroverted, you know, agreeable. You have a certain charm to you. And I could predict that if you ended up in going up to a bunch of people, you'd start talking to them and so on. I have another friend, a dear friend. He has none of these traits. He's lovable in many other ways. And I could guarantee if he went up to a bunch of new people, in 5 minutes, he'd be across the room staring at the wall, looking at his phone. And so on for 100 other things. People have personalities. This predicts their behavior. So what's the argument against?
It's a very good question. Even when I got my education, it was still fairly dogmatic. I think it's wrapped up in a whole bunch of maybe sociology of these scientists. But here's the best shot at giving social psychologists a fair reading. The idea was, if you want to know how a person is going to act in any given situation, and you have two sources of information. One is a personality test that they took 2 weeks ago that asks all kinds of broad questions like, do you like being at parties? Do you get anxious sometimes? Or, you know, the features of the situation, like this is a party for their fraternity. And now I want to predict how a person's going to act. The idea was that you get much more predictive power by knowing that they're going to be at a party at their own frat house.
Yeah.
The power of the situation. Now, this is a relatively benign example because I think the real action comes from more powerful situations than this, or like the real, I think, rhetorical force for this argument. But that's the idea. Chances are, if you're shy or you're extroverted or you're anxious or whatever, if I saw you at a party at your own frat house, you'd probably be having a good time and talking to people.
Yeah.
And now the real powerful demonstrations, or at least the ones that claimed to be very powerful, were ones showing that if you really turn up the pressure in certain situations, you can get people, regardless of their personality, to commit horrendous acts. And this was the point of the Milgram experiments. And you can see why that's a sexy claim to make.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, how this turned into personality doesn't matter, I don't know. Because obviously both things are kind of true.
Yeah, it's interesting where if the situation is extreme, maybe most everybody responds the same way. That we have to keep in mind, for I think every psychological experiment designed to get people to do terrible things or get people to conform, there's always a minority, sometimes a substantial minority, who say no. But I accept it. If I wake up and my house is on fire and the ceiling's on fire and there's smoke and alarms and like that, I'm going to be extremely anxious. And you could learn more about my anxiety, predict my anxiety better from saying my house is on fire than by giving me a personality test. Everyone would be anxious. Similarly, maybe for situations that are so banal and constraining that there's nowhere to go. You watch a bunch of people sitting on a streetcar, as they did this morning. And there's nothing to do but sit in a streetcar and look at your phone. So that's what everyone's doing. It doesn't allow people.
Look at all these introverts.
Yeah, look at all that's right. Look at all, nobody's agreeing with anything. It just seems like in the in-between world that we're interested in, personalities are real.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think that there was also, to get a little bit in the weeds, there was also an issue of measurement. There is a level of abstraction to certain personality dimensions or certain questions on personality tests that won't get you that much predictive power because they're really broad. So if I ask you in general, do you think of yourself as an extrovert? I'll get a lot less predictive power than if I ask you, do you like parties? At parties, do you like talking to people? What about when you meet a stranger at a coffee shop and they say hi to you? The minute you start getting to more specifics, of course, you're going to be able to do better at predicting those specific situations. And I'll finally add that this sociological phenomenon that I really do think that social psychologists, as people who were studying universals and who were using the experimental method, oh, we're going to bring people into the lab and who cares who it is? We're like physicists. We're going to put on a lab coat and we're going to give half of the people this condition and half of the people that condition, and we're going to show a difference. There was a little bit of superiority, I think, in the minds of the social psychologists, which in a huge turn of events, now the personality psychologists have the moral high ground, given what happened to my field.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's been a good time to be a personality psychologist.
Yeah.
Particularly because a lot of their findings have proven to be quite robust.
And because they cared so much about measurement, personality psychology has given us some of the best minds when it comes to the measurement of human beings.
Yeah.
And social psychologists, a lot of their failures can be chalked up to a failure to learn and appreciate how to measure things well.
Yeah. There's a deep point you made before, which is, you know, I always use introvert, extrovert as a go-to example for personality difference. And in fact, the major theory that we have, our field has about personality, says this is one of the fundamental components. There's like a dial you turn, and where you fall in introverted versus extroverted is one of five ways in which you differ from other people. But you're right that it's more complicated than that. Like, I think I really do have sort of a clear trait on this, but the truth is I really enjoy talking one-on-one to close friends, talking to you. And I actually don't mind standing in front of an audience of 1,000 people giving a talk. It kind of charges me up. It's everything in between that gets me.
I think people who saw you give, like the TED talk you gave recently, people would think, oh, if I go up to this guy, he's going to be just as charming. And the truth is you're just an anxious mess probably at that point.
You know, if it's one person, I'm just incredibly charming. Yeah. And they're amazing. But if three people go up to me, I immediately like look at my phone and they say, what's wrong with this person?
It's a Goldilocks effect.
I would have people over to my house when I lived in New Haven for like graduate student parties. And every once in a while, I'd hang out with the students with the press, and then I'd go upstairs. And fortunately, I had small children at the time, so I would like pretend to look in on the children. But I would really just check my email and just sit or sit in a quiet room because I found it overwhelming. And yet, I know a lot of people who could bubble around parties and love and need to have a lot of people around them, true extroverts in that sense, but they would find a bigger audience paralyzing. And none of this involves denying traits at all. These are traits. These are reliable facts about me. They're just more fine-tuned.
In your chapter, you mention that one of the big questions that personality psychologists have had is how many traits are there?
Yeah, that's right.
As you say, the dominant view is that there are five. And you mentioned that there is a rival view, maybe an older view, that says that there are 16. And the truth is, both of those can be true. The reality is, what level of abstraction do you want? So if you get to 16, you'll get slightly better at predicting what people do in any given situation. And if you get to 32 and, you know, 64 and you keep growing this, pretty soon you'll have a personality theory that is about every situation you've ever encountered. And then you'd have perfect predictability. So there is a little bit of sacrifice that you make when you want the more elegant, broader, reduced number of dimensions.
That's right. And it shows up when you talk about group differences. So there's an extroversion, introversion difference between men and women on average, but it's not very big. It's kind of subtle. But then you break it down into sort of more subscales, capturing different notions of behavior. Like if you want to view risk-taking as a form of extroversion, there is a very big sex difference. Men are much more prone to risk-take, again, on average, than women. If you want to view certain sort of nurture and caring behaviors as extroversion, which some people do, you get a flipped effect. And the more you zoom in, the better sort of you're able to characterize personality differences. You were talking about measurements. So what I like most about personality theory is the bad measurements because they're so much fun. I like the ones they have now where you have to determine your personality by figuring out what superhero you're most like. Or, and then there's the Rorschach test.
Yeah.
Have you ever taken it?
No, because I think that it's so tightly guarded. The ink blots that they use for the official Rorschach test, they're more guarded than the envelopes at the Oscars. So I've never actually taken one. Of course, I've seen the examples.
Yeah.
But have you?
No. Although they're quite common. They're used in custody hearings. They're used for training and for clinical psychology. And I also just as for a tidbit, Hermann Rorschach was obsessed with ink blots. And as a teenager, his nickname was Ink Blot. Which sounds like the origin story of a hero in The Watchmen.
That's hilarious. You know what's weird is every Rorschach ink blot that I've ever seen looks just like my mother spanking me.
Sometimes they get it right, but the story about it is that it's entirely bogus as a measurement. And there's two ways a scale could be wrong, could be a bad scale. One is that it's not reliable, meaning that if you test the same person on many times over again, you just get different results. It's like you stand on a scale and then you get like you're off by 5 pounds, you're off by 10 pounds. Whatever else you know about a scale, it's not reliable and can't be counted on. We talked before about the IAT, a measurement for assessment of implicit bias. And one of the criticisms is it's not that strong for reliability. The second concern about the Rorschach test is it doesn't seem to test anything. It's not valid. Since we're talking about tests, do you have an opinion about the Myers-Briggs?
I guess I do. It's not the best personality test by far, for a variety of reasons. But one reason is that it, rather than give you a continuous score on some of these traits, it forces you into one category or another. And that's just not a very good test. That's not a very good indicator of personality. I will say, though, that the hate for the Myers-Briggs, I think, is a little bit overblown. I mean, this is not the Rorschach. It is actually... Yeah. Making an attempt at measuring people on dimensions that, you know, are parts of other personality tests that are more well-respected. Myers-Briggs is a private company and they don't share their data a lot and they make a whole lot of money from their corporate gigs. So there's reasons to maybe be a little bit suspicious of it, but it's not terrible. You know, I think it says something about me that I am only off from you by one. I'm ENTP.
And Ian, that E is extroverted?
E is extroverted, yeah.
And what's the MTP again?
The intuitive thinking and, oh, geez.
Let's open up our Carl Jung. Yeah. I am very dismissive of Myers-Briggs. Now I feel a bit bad because you're right. These captures sort of intuitively important. Personality distinctions.
Judging, perceiving is that dimension. Thinking, feeling, sensation, intuition, introversion, extroversion. Yeah. I mean, look, I'm not a fan. I just think what has happened over the years is that so many excited undergrads who are interested in personality tests for the first time come up to you and they're so eager to talk to you about the Myers-Briggs. And it's a little bit of a wet blanket to say, that's terrible. This is a bullshit test.
Yeah.
But I assume that that's what you do.
I like nothing more than crushing dreams. You should hear me on astrology. But you're right. The weakness of the test, the main weakness is it categorizes people into a sort of one cell or another. Well, I think introversion, extroversion is actually a fairly plausible way to carve people apart. But it plainly is a matter of degree.
Yeah. And we don't have, you know, they don't share their data. So we don't really know what it predicts, whether these other dimensions are that good or not. And I think that serious personality researchers have done a much better job at coming up with dimensions using rigorous methods that we all know about. And there's a long history of trying to get to the best dimensions.
And it turns out that once you have the big five, just to go ahead and say it, it works on the acronym OCEAN. Open to new experience or not open to new experience, conscientious or not conscientious, extroverted or introverted, agreeable or antagonistic, and neurotic or stable. And one reason, there's some reason to take it seriously, which is you do the test where you're asking things, and it turns out your scores on the test predict real-world behaviors in a way that makes sense. If you're open to new experience, you change your jobs more. You have more body piercing. If you're conscientious, you're more faithful in your romantic relationships. You do well at school. If you're an extrovert, you have more friends. If you're agreeable, you're more successful at relationships. If you're neurotic, you have less success. It also has some predictive power regarding groups. So people have asked forever, what's the difference between liberals and conservatives? And there's an enormous debate over the nature of those differences. But sketched out in terms of personality, the story is there is two reliable differences. Liberals are more open to new experiences, and conservatives are more conscientious. And I kind of like that, because each group could say, yeah, we score high in something we value.
We've dipped our toe into individual differences and politics in some of our work. We've documented that one of the dimensions in which liberals and conservatives differ is disgust sensitivity, the propensity to feel disgusted at any given thing. And there again, it's not clear which way is good and which way is bad. I mean, some people seems like they ought to be more disgusted, and some people ought to be less disgusted.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, can we talk a little bit about how psychologists arrived at the Big Five? You mentioned Francis Galton in your chapter when you're talking about intelligence. But Galton also had this idea that people have referred to as the lexical hypothesis. The idea here is that the kinds of personality differences that matter would be ones that language picked up on. So we would have words for the dimensions that we cared about when we say this person is outgoing, this person is talkative, this person is an extrovert. Those all kind of share a similarity. And if you get all of the words that describe people on personality-like dimensions, and you try to put them into buckets where similar words are in the bucket with other similar words, and you do some fancy statistics to it, turns out that all of the words that we use to describe other people's personalities kind of fit into five buckets.
Yeah. You don't need both agreeableness and friendliness.
Yeah.
You're just wasting people's time by asking the question twice. They're pretty much the same. And so on for thousands of words. I was lecturing on personality a few weeks ago in my class, and a young woman asked what struck me as a very, very interesting, good question. Basically, she asked, so what's the best personality? And, you know, you talk about all these differences. And the supposition seems right. And it seems to a lot of people to be right. In fact, for instance, I think a lot of people think, it's better to be agreeable. It's better to be extroverted. It's bad to be neurotic. Openness is great, and so on. But I think there isn't really an answer to that question. I think it depends a lot on your situation and your life. And this is important. This may be why there are different personalities in the first place and why we're flexible in them. If you are a salesperson, if you are a DJ, good to be extroverted. If you are in a life situation where you talk to a lot of people and deal with a lot of different people, extroversion is a superpower. If you benefit from quiet scholarly study and being solitary and everything, being an extrovert is probably a disadvantage. You'd be unsatisfied and frustrated. I think agreeable people make the world a lot better, and I often prefer to deal with them. But people who are disagreeable are often heroes fighting injustice and saying, well, everyone else goes along. They say, I'm not going to go along. And for each of these things, you could find situations where it is better to be one or the other. So I don't think there is a right personality.
It's hard sometimes not to hear value judgments in the labels. Like neurotic just seems like a bad word.
Yes.
Right.
That's right.
But there are different ways that you have of dealing with your environment. And just to give one very broad example, if you are very open to exploring new things, you might find new sources of food, new mates. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
But you're also putting yourself in a great deal of risk, so you might die. So if you are a bit more wary about novel situations, you might live to see another day, but you won't reap the rewards of exploration. And which strategy is right? The answer can't be universal.
We'll talk about neurodiversity later on, but I think one of the morals is that we should be receptive to the fact that there's a broader range of cognitive and emotional and personality traits really serves a purpose. And people like Susan Cain, for instance, has been writing for a long time in The Power of Introverts, making the case against the normal default, extroverted is good, and saying, no, there's something to introverts to make the world better.
You know, one other finding is that personality is much more malleable early in life. By the time you're our age, our personality seems kind of, if you're going to be an extrovert, you're an extrovert by now. There's no flipping around. I experienced this. I was much more of an introvert as a child. So the first time I took the Myers-Briggs, actually, I was an introvert. I scored high in introversion, and then I became an extrovert.
You know, honestly, I don't know if this counts as life advice or just personal advice, but for me, at this phase of my life, I don't put as much effort into trying to change myself and these fundamental things. Rather, I try to find situations that play to my strengths.
Find people who can tolerate you and put those people around people. You.
I look for people. I'd rather change my personality. I just search desperately people who put up with my personality.
This episode of Psych is sponsored by GiveWell. When you give to charity, how much impact will your donation actually have? This question can be hard, if not impossible, to answer. Most charities just can't tell you how your money will be used or how much good it'll accomplish. You may know it could theoretically help a cause, but how? Or more importantly, how much? If you want to help people living in poverty with evidence-backed, high-impact charities, we recommend you check out GiveWell. GiveWell spends over 40,000 hours each year researching charitable organizations and only directs funds to a few of the highest impact evidence-backed opportunities they've found. Over 100,000 donors have used GiveWell to donate more than $1 billion. Rigorous evidence suggests that these donations will save over 150,000 lives and will improve the lives of millions more. Using GiveWell's research is absolutely free. GiveWell wants as many donors as possible to make informed decisions about high-impact giving. They publish all of their research and recommendations on their site for free. There's no need to sign up, no need to give any personal information. They want you to have it. They allocate your tax-deductible donation to the charity or fund you choose without taking a cut. So if you've never donated to GiveWell's recommended charities before, you can have your donation matched up to $100 before the end of the year or as long as matching funds last. To claim your match, go to GiveWell.org and pick podcast and enter psych at checkout. Make sure that they know you heard about GiveWell from Psych to get your donation matched. Our thanks to GiveWell for sponsoring this episode of Psych.
So if personality is one of the major ways people differ that we talk about as psychologists, another is intelligence. And there's just debate about personality. There's a lot of debate about intelligence. A few basics about intelligence. First, the average intelligence is 100, as tested by the IQ test. This isn't because of some miraculous convergence of a perfect number. It's because the tests are scaled to be at 100. It shows a sort of standard bell curve, which you could kind of just pluck up from your imagination. And IQ, as tested within societies like ours, it's not so clear. We get the same result in hunter-gatherer societies and so on, is related to most good things in life. So people with higher IQs are healthier, they're happier, they're kinder, according to various tests. They're less racist, they're less sexist, and they do better in life. They do better job performance in the military, they do better at school, they test better, and so on. I think it was Stuart Ritchie who said there's only one negative thing that correlates with high IQ, and that's bad eyesight.
Right. I think there is a very strong stereotype that people who are high in IQ are less happy. And that's just not borne out by the research. We have some stereotypes. We have the sort of image of a child prodigy who grows up to be miserable, but that's not the norm.
Yeah, that's right. There's obviously diminishing returns. So the difference between being an IQ of, say, 90 going up to 100 is very big. From 100 to 110 is really big. And then as it gets up and up and up, the difference fades. You get diminishing returns. And then kind of the same way you get diminishing returns from money. If you make $50,000 a year and somebody gives you another $50,000, that's going to make a huge difference. If you make $500,000, it won't be much of a difference. But some people have said that to this, say, well, and then too much intelligence is no good at all. Maybe it's bad for you. It makes you kind of awful in some way, takes you away from other people. It turns out not to be true. So I cite this study. I do a jokey thing in my book. I'll just read this aloud. I have it in front of me. In one classic decade-long study, psychologists took 320 children who tested before the age of 13 as having high mathematical or verbal skills at a top 10, one in 10,000. Then they looked at the same individuals 20 years later to see how they did in life, focusing on their occupations. And it turned out their lives were awful because they were total nerds. And then I write, no, I'm just kidding. You get to do that only once in a book before people hate you. But no, actually, they tended to do pretty well in life. They were scientists, journalists, politicians, CEOs, leaders in societies. Other studies looking at people in the top 1% of mathematical reasoning. And you might think mathematical reasoning, well, that's, you know, this isn't math. Who cares? But they were overrepresented in just all the good things, all the good jobs you want. They wrote more books. They had higher positions and so on. So there seems to be a positivity of intelligence. Now, the reason for the positivity is unclear. Let me just give a short riff on this, because something which has always interested me, I feel, because I think people often get it wrong. What you might be tempted to think is that your intelligence basically it makes you smarter, and smarter people thrive in some objective sense in the world. It's just better to be smart when dealing in the world. And I think that's true to some extent. But I also think, and this is a point brought up by people like Freddie DeBoer and Paige Harden, that to some extent, we have created a world where intelligence is highly valued. To get into the best schools in the United States, for instance, you have to do extremely well in academic testing on the SATs, later on the LSATs and everything. And these are in some way IQ tests. And once people end up in, you know, in Princeton or Harvard Law or whatever, their lives are very good. The world rewards their graduation from these places. But, and then psychologists come and say, look, IQs correlated positive life outcomes.
Amazing.
Amazing. But we set it up that way. I mean, again, not entirely. I think even if I think being smart in some unspecified way would be good no matter what. But so much of it is the result of a world in which this was prized. This is exceptionally prized.
I think that's a really good point, and one that I really never think about. But of course, that has to be true. I mean, we deal in admissions. We admit students, and you try your best to admit on the basis of a whole bunch of criteria, but we can't lie and say that intelligence isn't one dimension that we're trying to assess when we're picking who's going to be a PhD student with us. And I have the lay theory that that's because they will be better students. But I am also feeding into this very mechanism. We're causing these outcomes.
Yeah. It's like, just seeing an example on the fly, it would be as if we found that height is tremendously correlated with athletic skills, and the only athletic sport we had was basketball.
Yeah.
And it was like, well, it's an enormous correlation, height and that. But if we had other sports, the correlation would drop. We're going to talk about heredity and where these things come from in a bit. But the logic extends deeper than that. Suppose you find that there's a real genetic influence on say, getting a PhD or getting a great job. The genetic influence might work that it wires up, the genes wire up your brain to be really smart and capable, and that's how it works. But it doesn't have to work that way. In any society, and this applies to all societies, where there's some other biases, the genes could instead code in ways that favor the biases. So suppose being good looking helps you get a good job and helps you get into a good school, and there's probably enormous bias in favor of the good looking. Then the genes will have an effect on this, because genes have some effect on how good looking you are. Suppose skin color plays a role in your fate in life, also true everywhere on Earth. Then your genes will have an effect, a correlation on your fate in life, because genes control skin color. This isn't just sort of being picky. It's worth appreciating that genetic influence on an accomplishment, even an accomplishment of value, may be mediated, may do its work through something else society has, and maybe something society shouldn't have.
I already know some listeners are going to say, well, you've been talking about IQ and intelligence as if they are the same thing. And there are a lot of people who are suspicious of IQ tests. And so equating intelligence with IQ is maybe for some people something that has to be defended.
Yeah. And I think I actually think that's a fair enough objection. They're different things. Intelligence is sort of a hypothesized notion of sort of a general reasoning ability.
Reason, plan, yeah. Learn from experience, adapt to novel circumstances.
And an IQ test is a test. Is a test of that that people have thought up. So, I don't, for instance, you could be incredibly intelligent, but if you can't read the words on IQ tests because you don't know language and no one's offered you a translation, or you come from another culture, or you're visually impaired, no one offers to give you any help to it, you'll do terrible on IQ tests, even though you could be very smart. So I think what you could say is the fact that the IQ test seems to have various predictive power. I think in general, somebody who scores 140 is going to just be a better reasoner than someone who scores 100 suggests that there's some correlation. But you absolutely cannot conflate intelligence with the test to assess intelligence any more than you should reduce personality to the test we use to assess personality. And this is why particularly I think we should be very skeptical about studies that apply IQ tests often created for use in the United States. And then apply them to other countries. Because there's all sorts of reasons when you sort of diverge from the situation where people are sort of most, have the test most crafted, where these tests start to go awry. Even something as simple as, there's a certain thing called test-taking skill, which you get in school. And you probably, if you dropped an intelligence test for people who had no formal education, no matter how smart they are, they're going to bomb it. Because they just don't know how to take tests.
Yeah. I mean, anxiety can do that to many students, yep. For instance. Yeah.
That's right. Should we talk about G?
Yeah, I think so. So an IQ test is attempting to find the underlying dimension of intelligence, right? So the attempt is to say, what can we measure that will tell us whether or not somebody's intelligent or not? And over the years, people have developed a whole bunch of different kinds of tasks. And if you take an IQ test or if you've taken one, you'll realize that you're getting a bunch of different kinds of questions. Some of them may involve reaction time. Some of them may involve memory. Some are just about verbal ability or ability to recognize, to know words. Some are just mathematical ability or your ability to do calculations in your head. So the question might be, well, if an IQ test has, say, 5 components, who's to say that you just haven't measured 5 things? How can you lump all of these together?
An analogy I like to think about is an athletic analogy.
Yeah, it's a great one. Yeah,
and this is one. It's not original to me, but I put it in a book, which is, you know, it could be that these 5 things were totally separate, in which case they'd be totally unrelated. So, you know, certainly some things are highly separate. If you tested, I don't know, tested people on how far they could jump, and when they roll a dice, do they get a heads or a tails? They're just totally different. The components of an intelligence test seem to be connected similar to the components of athletic tests. So imagine you brought in people and you had a bunch of tests. You had how fast can you run a mile? How much can you bench press? How flexible are you? On and on, different things. Now, plainly some people are going to do better than others on this. So you'll have somebody who's just this weightlifter who could bench press an enormous amount, but not so flexible. You could have this person who is an incredibly fast runner, but doesn't have much upper body strength. You get a difference. You get different scores. Everybody will have a different profile. But you'll also notice something else, which is there are some people in general who are pretty physically fit. A young man or woman, 20 years old, who does sports at school, probably do pretty well at all of these. A 90-year-old, sickly with various conditions, will probably do poorly on all of these. And so in addition to the separate scores, you could have a sort of score, which is how much overall do you do? But we call that for intelligence G.
I think you say this in the book. It didn't have to turn out this way.
That's right.
They're all pretty highly correlated with each other. It really didn't have to turn out that way, but that it did is, I think, a good piece of evidence that we're capturing something general, and there's the G is for general, means something. Now, why? It could be that your G, your overall score, is capturing something basic about mental capacities, like could be just like a processor. This is capturing like just how powerful your brain is. But it could be that the tasks that are being measured have some serious overlap in the domain. So some of them might be about memory plus arithmetic, and some of them are about arithmetic plus processing speed, and so on. So you're getting overlapping measurement of certain domains. I think it's up for debate, but I don't think that there is a lack of evidence that there is a reasonable way in which we can say this is capturing some broad dimension.
Yeah, I think so. And I think you're right in saying not only is it sort of logically possible these components could have been separate, a lot of people think they are separate. Like there's a cliche, and I, for all I know, I once probably believed it, which is you have somebody who's very brainy at math, they're not going to have a high vocabulary. Yeah, they have this big, they're math specialists and they don't read and so on. They'll be worse than average in reading. And it's just not true. But we have this conservation view. We have it more generally. You see somebody who's good looking and a jock, and you think, maybe because you think there's some sort of cosmic justice. Well, they're not going to be so smart. Frustratingly, for some of us, people who are good looking and strong and good at math are also good at poetry on average, and also, you know, show other abilities. Well, sadly, if you're bad at just about every, if you're bad at a five of six things, the odds are not that for the sixth thing, you're going to be skyrocketingly good. Hey, for the sixth thing, you won't be so good either. And, you know, we think of all sorts of reasons for that. Some psychological, some social. Which is, if you have a lot of gifts, maybe you're in an environment that nourishes all of your gifts in a way much more than somebody who has fewer gifts.
There is a difference, at least one, that intelligence researchers like to point out. So you can divide intelligence into what they refer to as fluid intelligence and crystallized intelligence. I've always thought maybe this is just a way of making aging people feel a bit better about themselves. So fluid intelligence means the raw processing power. That stuff, unfortunately, starts going down with age. At a pretty early age, if you look at just raw like processing speed, I once saw a presentation, I think it was at Google actually, where they had these data. They had age and they had the ability to perform some of these tasks. And in the early 20s, you already start seeing a decline. Very depressing. Those go down. But crystallized intelligence, which here means, for instance, the knowledge that you accrue over time, like the number of vocabulary words that Paul knows has just, it's greater than the ones that he knew 30 years ago, I assume.
I think extremely slowly, but I have a lot of words accumulated in my head. It takes me a while to get them out.
So this increases with age. It's meaningful because I think we value the quickness and the ability to, you know, the raw processing power of a brain seems impressive. And in some fields, for instance, physics and math, it just is true that that's what gets you success. In other fields, like some of the humanities, history, some areas of philosophy, you just
psychology.
We just get better with age. What is required of us improves, our performance improves with the knowledge and maybe even the wisdom that we acquire accrue over time.
So people are going to wonder this. Well, they hear us talk. We're talking about IQ, personality, and now intelligence is measured by IQ tests. But people are going to wonder about multiple intelligences, the idea of other intelligences. What's your take on that?
You know, this is one of the debates that boils down to, much like what you said with language in the previous episode. I was asking you, you know, do animals have language? Did Coco have language? And you said something very wise because of your high crystallized intelligence. You said,
but look, slow. You had to edit out to 10 minutes.
If you want to call it an intelligence, sure. So Howard Gardner, intelligence researcher, has proposed probably the most famous theory of multiple intelligences. He says, well, we have musical intelligence, we have kinesthetic intelligence. And I take it the point that he's making is that in a culture that worships IQ, it's important to point out that there are other differences that are important for performance, for success, for happiness. And so, you know, he has, I think, 7. To that, I say, sure, if you want to call musical intelligence an intelligence, I call it an ability. I just say, yes, there are different abilities. We all have different abilities. I like to reserve the term intelligence for this domain of cognitive tasks. That doesn't mean, though, that, you know, I studied with Peter Salovey, who proposed a theory of emotional intelligence. That word is fine. It's fine. It's just a different thing.
And one other twist to this, whatever you call it, these other intelligences are, you know, plainly matter in life, you know, emotional intelligence, which has many meanings, but the main meaning is you understand people, you get along with people, you could understand what they're doing. You could, you have maybe some knowledge of your own intentions and goals, but these other intelligences correlate often pretty highly with regular, good old fashioned intelligence. Yeah. So the person who has this ridiculously high IQ will probably also have pretty good emotional intelligence. I don't know as well about things like kinesthetic intelligence or musical intelligence.
Another theory is Bob Sternberg, former colleague of yours, current colleague of mine. He has a triarchic theory of intelligence. So he, what we've been talking about in terms of IQ, he calls analytical intelligence. But he also thinks that there's practical intelligence, intelligence that you might have for everyday tasks, and then creative intelligence.
I think there's a real enthusiasm for finding more types of intelligence, because for all of us, we know people who score, who would score higher, or just plainly more intelligence in this narrow, intelligent narrow sense than we are. And it's very comforting for us to say, but there's other intelligences that we too may excel at. And I understand that, and it may be right. I guess I would just say, and this is an argument I make in passing in my book, it's more political and psychological, which is society doesn't have to value intelligence quite as much as it does.
Yeah.
There's so many advantages in a world where a university education is extremely important to being able to sit still and take tests. And there's less advantages to be accrued by other gifts, like being courageous or being kind. I just think there could be a bit of a recalibration there. This is my hippie moment.
I totally agree. And I think ironically, it's just adding to the worship of intelligence. It's trying to bank on the same phenomenon that people think intelligence is the most important thing, to call these things intelligences.
That's right. My kid can run fast. You know, that's movement intelligence. So he's smart too. So now we're getting to one of the core questions here, which is we talked about differences, different kinds of differences, why they matter, social forces and why they matter, intrinsic forces, why they matter. And then the question is, where do they come from? Why are we different? And there's an enormous amount of research on this, a lot from the field of behavioral genetics. And I'll just get the ball rolling by pointing out one finding, and it's what Eric Turkheimer, who's somewhat of a critic of behavioral genetics, but Eric Turkheimer coins the first law of behavioral genetics. And the first law is basically everything psychological is heritable. And what that means is that everything to some extent or another having to do with how we think, the variance between people is to some extent correlated with genes. What this means in a more casual way is, if I wanted to know how religious you are, how extroverted you are, what kind of sense of humor you have, if I could find your biological mother and biological father and test them on these traits, I could predict pretty well how you would answer, even if they never raised you.
Right.
Just as I could predict how tall you are to some extent by looking how tall your mom and dad are, and the color of your hair and how much you weigh and so on. Say so too for your psychological traits.
If somebody asks you what is the heritability, and we'll get to what specifically that word means, but if somebody asks you what the heritability of insert psychological trait here is, if you say about 0.5, you won't be too far off.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And there's a million measures for it. Some of them are very clever. Like you compare my biological child with the child I adopt. These children will be raised by the same parents. So whatever effect of that sort of environment has will be reflected in both of them, but they'll have different genes. You look at identical twins raised differently. They have the same genes, but different environments. I think a lot of the work, and it's going to be more and more work, just skips all of these crazy scenarios and just goes to the genes themselves. And there's these ways in which people analyze the genomes, or chunks of the genomes, of thousands, maybe millions of people, and then does the math to determine the extent to which certain genetic variants are correlated with certain things you're interested in, like schizophrenia or educational attainment or extroversion. And that way we get a good estimate of heritability.
Now, in these studies, the mistake that people make is to say, oh, so you found the IQ gene. I think we learn about genetics by talking about blue eyes and brown eyes, that basic story about how single genes can influence a physical trait. And the mistake is to think that this is what's going on here.
That's right. And there are many laws of behavioral genetics. What has been coined the fourth law of behavioral genetics is that any complex psychological trait will be determined by a cluster of genes, sometimes hundreds or thousands or many thousands. So the idea that there's a gene for X, a single gene that does the trick, seems to be, I mean, it could have been that way, but it seems to be empirically mistaken. I will read out the fourth law. A typical behavioral trait is associated with very many genetic variants, each which accounts for a very small percentage of the behavioral variability. And by the way, if one of the practical implications of this has to do with genetic engineering, it's a social and moral debate that we could steer clear of, but just that if you wanted to fiddle with somebody's genes to make them smarter or more extroverted or kinder, it's not like there's a single gene there. And that determines it. Each gene plays just a tiny role. And it's the same for traits like height. There's no height gene. What determines whether somebody's, you know, how tall somebody is determined by this enormous cluster of genes.
There's another thing that people trip up on. You use a nice example in your book, which is that heritability is a measure of an individual difference. There are things that are produced by our genes that don't differ across individuals. I think you use the example of, you know, having a brain is caused by your genes, right? So that's not what heritability means in this sense.
That's right. Heritability is all about differences. So to ask how heritable is it to have a brain? Well, everybody has a brain.
Yeah.
You know, if you ask how heritable it is to have two legs, interestingly, the heritability of having two legs is fairly low. Because people who have fewer than two legs typically lost them due to some sort of accident, and that's environmental. So that's one aspect of it. Another aspect of it is things like how well you do at college basketball is pretty heritable. And it's a big mistake to say, oh my gosh, there are genes for college basketball. This is not true at all. There's no, you know, genes did not evolve for college basketball. What there are genes for a cluster of abilities, maybe being tall, being athletic. A whole cluster of those things converge to make you good at college basketball. And again, from the examples of, say, eye color or skin color or attractiveness, a cluster of genes that correlate, make heritable, some sort of intellectual attainment like graduating from college, doesn't have to affect your brain at all. It could work through other routes. So there's a big surprise in behavioral genetics. This is maybe the most surprising thing I say to my intro psych class. And some days I don't believe it myself, but there's enough evidence for it. The surprise isn't that so much of our mental life, our mental differences, are controlled by the gene, say, correlate 50% or whatever. The surprise is where the other 50% comes from. So a lot of people think, okay, how intelligent I am, how introverted, extroverted, how happy I am. A big, big chunk of that's determined by my genes, say 50%. The other 50% I must get from my mom and dad, how they raised me. And it turns out the evidence suggests that that's not true. The evidence suggests that the other 50%, the environment, the stuff that's not genetic, doesn't really come from the household. There's a lot of evidence that how you're raised within people who are not coming from severe poverty or severe abuse doesn't have that much of a role on your IQ or your personality. To put it differently, parents matter an enormous amount. Parents matter because they typically provide the genes that make you to a tremendous extent. Parents matter because how they raise you plays a huge role in how all of those years, more than a decade of childhood, how that works out, how happy you are. But parents, in terms of how they parent you, doesn't seem to have a big effect on whether you're open to new experience, agreeable, neurotic, and so on.
So this raises a really cool question. If it's not your genes and it's not how you were parented that makes you different, what is it? What's the missing piece of the environment? And nobody knows. Some people think it's your peer group, that causes your personality to change in some way. Some people think it's just your random events that happen in people's lives. You know, you fall in love, you get sick right before an exam, you win a lottery, you get hit by a car, and that this plays a role. And I just find this a really neat question, but I don't have much to say about it. So let's get back to parenting. What do you think? Do you buy this claim that parents don't matter?
I think that it is such a natural thought as a parent that all of your behaviors are going to determine the psychology of your child. Like, am I exposing my daughter to books or classical music? Am I feeding her brain in the right way? And maybe we as Americans, this gets back to the question that we talked about in development, that parents in the United States often want to play this very important role in maximizing how good their kids are at all sorts of things. It's a tough pill to swallow, though.
Yeah, it is. It is. And there's so many forces that kind of push us away from it. First thing, there of course is, unless your kid is adopted, there's going to be this tremendous similarity between you and your kid. You know, I'm a nervous guy. My kids are nervous. I say, wow. And it's easy to infer I made them nervous from how I raised them, and not appreciate the possibility that if they're raised in another family, it might be just as nervous. I have two wonderful sons, both adults now, and they're totally different people.
Yeah, they couldn't be more different.
They could not be. They excel in totally different ways, but they are totally different people. Now their genes were different. The random shuffle of genes make them genetically different. But I think to the extent I parented in certain ways, I think they responded to my parenting in very different ways. I just, I find this thing first shocking. And then I had two kids and then I just said, yeah, I can see it. Parents don't matter that much from a standpoint of parenting. I got to say, and maybe we could end on something like this about differences, which is sometimes people freak out when they hear this and they say, I often without thinking deeply about it said, well, why should I bother to spend so much time and energy with my kids if I'm not going to shape how they are? But if you think about that, like first thing, you probably spend a lot of time and energy hanging out with your partner, and nobody believes we could change our husband and wife thinks right. He's the world. I mean, we're smarter than that.
That's a very good point.
but also you want to be with your kid because presumably, you know, you love your kid, and parents may not have a power to shape the kid's personality or intelligence, not much of one, but we have an immense power to give the kid a happy childhood or a sad one, to give them places where they can be fulfilled and get enjoyment and excitement and adventure and security and so on. Or we could raise them horribly and make their early lives a burden, at which point when they're old enough to escape us, they will hate us and never see us again. I choose option one.
Right. And you point out in your chapter that there may be a lot of things that either we haven't measured,
yep,
or we can't measure because they're too complicated. But there are small things. You know,
yeah,
you create a safe environment for them. They know that they can turn to you for help. Even as adults, they trust you. They learn to trust other people. You teach them certain explicit things.
Yep.
And we might teach them about moral principles, or we might just show them by example, by spending enough time around them. And these might be things that we haven't gotten around to studying well.
Yeah, I think for something particularly as important as this, we should be humble. I find the behavioral genetics evidence for the sort of non-effects of parenting to be very impressive. But we should be humble both that maybe something's gone wrong in these studies and we're going to find out some new stuff later. And also, there's all sorts of things the studies don't address. Often that has value. And it can't be an accident how many children end up in the family business. You could say it's genes. But, you know, I know more than one father and daughter who are both professional academic philosophers. I know of a father and son who are both butchers. And often you have influences that way. I'll end with this. One of my nieces loves Italian sports cars, draws them, wants to design them, studies them and everything. Can it be a coincidence that her father is obsessed with Italian sports cars? Well, maybe. I don't think it's the genes. I think there you see environment.
You could just bite the bullet and say, whether my kid's going to be an extrovert or an introvert is not in my control. But as you said, whether you're going to have an extrovert who calls you when they're an adult is under your control.
Yes, that's I think, an exceptionally profound point to end on.
Great. Well, thanks, Paul.
Thank you.